Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Healthcare Regulations Subcommittee, January 24th, 3:30 p.m. We're starting on time, ending on time, and coming in under budget. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Clemens.
Here.
Representatives Barrero.
Here.
Bartleman.
Here.
Abbott.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Bell.
Here.
Black.
Here.
Cheney. Franklin. Humchowski.
Here.
Persons Mullica.
Here.
Rudman.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tant excused. Trabuzzi. Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina. If all members and guests would please silence any noise-making devices that you might have, that would really please us and allow the Sergeant of Arms not to, address your condition of health or anything like that. So, since this is a health care committee, our primary responsibilities as legislators is to pass legislation that's for the good of the citizens and the constituents that we represent. That benefit all of Florida. Equally important, sometimes we overlook the responsibilities to ensure that the legislation that we passed in former sessions is being properly implemented. And that's what we're doing today. We're going to hear from the Department of Health on the efforts it has undertaken to implement a statewide fetal infant mortality review programs that was required by last session's HB 5. So I imagine Representative Persons Mullica will be particularly interested in the update because she was the co-sponsor of HB 5. And so today we'll also receive an overview of the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. The program provides subsidized medical insurance for children with family incomes higher than the Medicaid eligibility level and offers to pay full pay for product families' higher incomes that wish to purchase the child-only coverage. So, Ms. Melissa Jordan, would you please come forward? You're the Assistant Deputy Secretary for the Department of Health. Welcome, and we look forward to your presentation. You have the floor.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Clemens, Vice Chair Barrero, Ranking Member Bartleman, and members of the Healthcare Regulations Subcommittee. My name is Melissa Jordan, and I serve as the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Health at the Florida Department of Health. Thank you for this opportunity to present to you this afternoon. I'm here to present information on the department's implementation of fetal and infant mortality reviews. Fetal and infant mortality review, also referred to as FEMR, is an action-oriented community and evidence-based process that reviews fetal and infant deaths, formulates programs, and influences policy that will lead to improving pregnancy and birth outcomes. The goal of FEMR is to assess, monitor, and improve service systems and resources for women, infants, and families. Historically, there were 11 fetal and infant mortality review committees in Florida covering 25 counties, funded by the Title V Maternal and Child Health Block Grant. House Bill 5 was passed during the 2022 legislative session, directing the Department of Health to contract with Healthy Start coalitions for the creation of FEMR committees statewide. The committees are responsible for reviewing and analyzing data, developing recommendations, implementing policies and procedures, and reporting findings to the department. This process will result in local actions and a comprehensive statewide plan to improve birth outcomes. During my presentation, I will explore each step of the process in greater detail. But first, I'm going to provide more context on fetal and infant deaths on the next two slides. A fetal death or stillbirth is the loss of a baby at 20 weeks or more gestation. In 2021, there were 1,572 fetal deaths in Florida. The fetal death rate is the number of fetal deaths per 1,000 deliveries. This rate allows us to look at trends while controlling for changes in the underlying population. This graph displays data trends from 2016 to 2021 for Florida, shown in orange, and the U.S., shown in blue. Please note that the U.S. data for 2021 is not yet available. Trends in fetal death rates have remained relatively flat, with Florida's rates being slightly higher than the U.S. each year. The table on this slide shows the three leading causes of fetal deaths in Florida in 2021. which includes complications of the placenta, cord, or membranes, maternal complications of pregnancy, and maternal conditions unrelated to the present pregnancy. This includes health conditions such as injuries and chronic diseases. Infant mortality is defined as death during the first year of life. In 2021, there were 1,267 infant deaths in Florida. The infant mortality rate is the number of infant deaths per 1,000 live births. Similar to the previous slide, this graph shows data trends for 2016 to 2021 for Florida, shown in orange, and the U.S., shown in blue. Again, please note the U.S. data for 2021 is not yet available. The table shows the three leading causes of infant deaths in Florida in 2021 and includes perinatal conditions, which refer to health events that occur immediately before or after birth. This includes cord complications, respiratory conditions, and hemorrhage. Congenital malformations, otherwise known as birth defects. And lastly, unintentional injuries. Examples include drowning, motor vehicle accidents, or suffocation related to an unsafe sleep environment. The department is using the National FEMUR Framework as the guide to implement the state's FEMUR program. This includes a cycle of improvement for health providers, systems, and the community as a whole. This goes beyond examining rates and trends by identifying causes and providing context on individual cases. The cycle of improvement begins with gathering information to ensure that a comprehensive picture of the circumstances that led to the birth outcome is identified. This can include information related to prenatal care, mental health services, substance use identification or treatment, medical care, services accessed by the family, and any other relevant information. Once the data are obtained, a de-identified overview of the case is prepared to share with the case review team. Next, reviews are performed by a multidisciplinary team referred to as the case review team that reviews individual cases of fetal and infant deaths, identifies contributing factors, and develops recommendations at the individual provider and community level to improve birth outcomes. The case review team includes representation of medical and agency professionals that provide healthcare services and resources to families within the community. Examples include direct service providers, social service agencies, and county health departments. A second team, known as the Community Action Group, then receives the recommendations from the case review team. The FEMUR Community Action Group provides an opportunity for joint effort of community leaders, healthcare administrators, and local agencies to ensure the recommendations are put into action to improve birth outcomes. Participants on the Community Action Group include individuals and local agencies that impact prevention, intervention, and policy. Examples include Healthy Start coalitions, healthcare providers, and chambers of commerce. The final step in the process is changes in community systems where outcomes for families will be improved. Examples of community systems change include increasing home visiting support to families in need of services, providing safe sleep education, and increasing the number of medical providers available locally for pregnant women and infants. The successes of FEMUR implementation include the following: creation of data-driven allocation methodology for statewide expansion, implementation of case review teams and community action groups statewide, development of an electronic process for timely and secure transmission of birth and death certificate data, and implementation of a comprehensive training plan for Healthy Start coalitions that includes all steps of the FEMUR process. As previously highlighted, the department historically provided funding to 11 Healthy Start coalitions covering 25 counties for FEMR activities. Each of the 11 FEMRs conducted a review of 28 cases, equaling 308 cases reviewed statewide annually. Three additional counties leveraged local resources to implement FEMR in their community. The outcomes of these efforts have provided the foundation, including valuable key strategies for statewide expansion. Through collaboration with the Healthy Start coalitions, it was determined that FEMRs would be implemented in 21 regions. Some regions consist of a single Healthy Start coalition, while others include multiple Healthy Start coalitions. Regional implementation allows FEMRs to maintain case confidentiality and leverage resources locally. This implementation will increase the number of cases reviewed annually to over 700 and be representative of all 67 counties in the state. The department, in coordination with partners, has identified national and state metrics and targets to track progress toward reducing fetal and infant mortality. The 2022 to 2026 State Health Improvement Plan, Florida's roadmap to increase the health of Floridians, includes an objective to address the Black infant mortality rate, striving to reduce it from 11.3 per 1,000 live births in 2021 to 9.6 per 1,000 live births by 2026. At a national level, the Healthy People goals identify public health priorities to help individuals, organizations, and communities across the United States improve health and well-being. The Healthy People 2030 goal for fetal deaths is to reduce the rate of fetal deaths at 20 or more weeks gestation from 7.28 to 5.7 per 1,000 deliveries by the year 2030. The Healthy People 2020 goal for infant mortality was to reduce the rate of infant deaths to 6 per 1,000 live births. Florida achieved that goal. The Healthy People 2030 goal is to reduce the rate of infant deaths from 5.85 to 5 per 1,000 live births by 2030. Information obtained through the FEMR process will be critical in supporting Florida's efforts in this area. The department will also be developing and submitting an annual report that includes FEMR findings and recommendations to the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House of Representatives by October 1st of this year, and annually each year after. This report will provide an opportunity to review local findings that represent all regions of the state and implement statewide actions to improve pregnancy and birth outcomes. That concludes my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan. Questions from the members. I'm certain you have some questions. Representative Franklin.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, all that you do for Florida. My question is around the data gathering. Are we ever able to look at whenever maybe a NICU within a hospital might open up a NICU state? How does that impact infant mortality? And then also when you kind of look at different reasons why it's happening, are you seeing a higher incidence rate maybe in more rural communities or communities that don't have NICUs in those hospitals? Just kind of curious as an information with data gathering in that space.
Great. Ms. Jordan, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for that question, Representative. So the nice thing about the FEMR process is that it really provides that greater context around each individual death. So we're able to look at medical history, access to care. And so I think with this expansion where we'll have more coverage and representation from more rural areas, we'll be able to see if that access to services, piece is an issue, or what other, hospital-based interventions we might recommend or other policy changes to improve access to care, or think more creatively about maternal telehealth or other things that might improve access in rural areas.
Thank you. Follow up? Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Can you put some parameters around why Florida's fetal mortality and infant mortality rates are higher than the national average?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. It is something that we I think we'll be able to compare more now that we'll have statewide data with the U.S. data. But keep in mind, we have a, you know, sometimes the comparison at the national level is not the same as the comprehensive data we collect in Florida. So we look at some of the data we have consistently at the state and national level, like birth certificate data that's collected in a standardized way, so that we can make some comparisons to our outcomes compared with the U.S. But I think once we get into, like, you know, being able to drill down, that's where the data starts to kind of come apart a little bit for us. But I do think that as we start to have this statewide data, we'll have a more comprehensive picture, and hopefully we'll be able to continue to work with the other states that are expanding their FEMR access to see what differences, because we're not just interested in risk factors, we're interested in protective factors, right? And that's something that we might get from a national perspective too, is if there are areas, not just the U.S., but other states or counties that have lower rates, we'd like to be able to access that data and understand why. What have they implemented that's increased access to care?
Would you care for a follow-up? All right. Representative Rudman, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask, look, referring back to the fetal mortality statistics, the 1,581 fetal deaths, I see that we have the top three ranked. Two-part question. Number one, I was wondering if I could get the entire list of root causes for the 1,581 fetal deaths, not just the top three. Would that be possible?
You're recognized.
Yes, absolutely. We could give you more details on that.
Would you please share that with the rest of the committee
we'll share
when you do that, so that way?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to follow up on that, I'm looking at the third item listed, maternal conditions, which may be unrelated to the current pregnancy. Mm-hmm. I assume, is that the category where you would factor in things like smoking, diabetes, drug use?
You're recognized.
That's exactly right. So it's the kind of external factors, chronic conditions, substance use would probably, for the most part, be captured there. But we like to think of it as like chronic diseases not related to the pregnancy. So diabetes, you know, not gestational diabetes.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representative Tribolsi, you're recognized for a question, comment.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your time today. My question is in regards to Black infant mortality, which we're paying specific attention to. And you're going from 11.3 per 1,000. Do you know what that number actually is for, you know, 2021? What does that equate to?
The actual number?
Yes.
You know what? I don't have it in front of me. I do know that our provisional 2022 data shows a rate of 10.2. So we've continued to be level for non-Hispanic Blacks as well as other populations. But we can get the more detailed information showing the counts.
Thank you.
We'll provide that. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Parsons Mullica, co-sponsor of HB5. You have the floor for questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick comment and then a question. First, I want to say thank you to you and your entire department and to everyone who either on the state level or the local level works on these FEMRs. From my experience in the legislature, I've been able to see firsthand the work that they're doing and their ability to empower communities to dig deep into the issues specific to that community and find solutions so that our babies have a fighting chance and can live their life and find their opportunity and passion. So I thank you for that. I have two questions I just wanted to follow up on. One, and you just hit on it briefly, if we're seeing any preliminary numbers for 2022 and what trends those might show. And then two, in terms of the data being collected and the information that you receive on the state level, how often during the year do the Healthy Start coalitions report to you their findings from these FEMRs? And then I look forward to the annual reports.
Recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that, and thanks for acknowledging the hard work. You know, this is very hard work, especially for the abstraction teams and others that have to, you know, deal with this difficult issue, but the data that we get from it is so valuable. So in terms of the preliminary data, you know, the breakdown per region doing the abstraction is pretty small, and so we'll be receiving most of the data annually to be able to roll up into this aggregated state report. But I think the value in having this, you know, in being able to use this to create true statewide interventions is going to be so huge. So I know we're all looking forward to it. I'm sure everyone is here to that October 1st report, and then we'll be able to look at preliminary data after that, but it will be an annual update for the most part.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow up, do you anticipate the report digging down into the data by county, showing a rate by county or by the FEMR region? As a second part, I know we've had some data in the past regarding the infant mortality rates by county, and that might be something helpful to share with the committee.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thanks for that follow-up, and we absolutely can. We routinely share that with county health departments and other local partners. The county-level data, I think, is so important to drive action, and then I think we'll be looking at it at a FEMR regional level, too, so that we can monitor those trends and then start to evaluate the efforts the FEMRs are making.
Other members have questions? Well, I want to thank you for being here today and testify on your behalf. My only daughter is a labor and delivery nurse, and she spent quite some time of her tenure in the NICU unit. And, you know, she doesn't divulge any, you know, patient information, but she is one of the caring nurses that you're familiar with, that when the mother's child is delivered and it's not alive, you know, the trauma that comes to those parents during that time. And she has on many occasions wrapped the baby, and the mother spends time holding the baby. Sometimes there's pictures taken with the parents and others. And so my heart goes out to anybody that's involved in that part of our healthcare program. Now, the question that I have before we go to the next is when Representative Skidmore asked about some differentiation sometimes between Florida and the reporting, can you give us some indication as a committee of the differentiations or the outliers, or the other factors maybe that other states do not capture? And that may be some reason for some discrepancies in the way that these things are reported, if you can.
Yes, thanks for that. Well, I think we'll have to go back and follow up to see what that looks like. But my guess would be that a lot of the FEMR work happening at the national level is the same way that we used to approach it in Florida, is, you know, maybe funding a few larger, you know, areas, metro areas, where we have enough of a sample size to be able to dig in and get some generalizable information from that. So I'm not sure that we have something comprehensive to kind of compare our Florida efforts to.
Okay. Last bite of the apple. Any members? Representative Skidmore, anything? Anything at all? All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Jordan, for your presentation today. We have another presentation, members, from the Chief Operations Officers of the Florida Healthy Kids Corporation, Mr. Austin Knoll. Welcome, Mr. Knoll. And you have the floor to make your presentation. Thank you.
Sure. Is this on?
There you go.
Good afternoon, Chair Clemens, Vice Chair Barrero, and Ranking Member Bartleman. As the chair introduced, I am Austin Knoll, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chief Operating Officer for Florida Healthy Kids Corporation, which is one of four partners that make up Florida Kid Care. I am before you today to provide an overview of children's health insurance in Florida. Specifically, we'll be focused on the key elements of Florida Kid Care. How did it come into existence? How is it funded? Which entities are involved and their roles, the benefits, as well as the operating models of Medicaid and CHIP, along with eligibility, funding, and enrollment. With that, let's dive in. So first, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP for short, is an insurance program focused on the specific needs of children. It provides affordable, comprehensive, quality health coverage to children living in families that earn more than Medicaid allows. In Florida, child-focused care healthcare began in 1992 as a county-level program. It quickly expanded and eventually served as the model for what would become CHIP as passed in the Balanced Budget Act in 1997. CHIP is now a statewide program, and unlike Medicaid, CHIP is not an entitlement program. Instead, it must be authorized by Congress from time to time, and it is currently authorized with federal funding through 2029. Funding for CHIP is achieved through family contributions, federal assistance, and state funding. With CHIP, families contribute $15 or $20 per month per household. The remaining costs are funded jointly by states and the federal government through the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, or FMAP for short. Each state's FMAP is based on the state's per capita income compared to the national per capita income. In essence, the lower a state's average per capita income, the higher the FMAP, and vice versa. This FMAP rate is updated annually through as part of the Social Services Estimating Conference. So what does this mean? In numbers, when we look at this, the FMAP or match rate, it does differ between Medicaid and CHIP. CHIP receives an enhanced match rate to help incentivize coverage for children. The additional federal assistance reduces the financial burden on the state when covering kids. As part of the public health emergency, Medicaid and CHIP received additional federal match rates, further lowering the state share. This allowed for states to focus their funds towards other legislative initiatives. However, there are two primary requirements for receiving the additional funding. First, once enrolled in Medicaid, a child must remain enrolled in Medicaid unless certain exceptions occur. Second, eligibility criteria could not become more strict since January 2020. So as we look at this chart, line by line, we see that the Medicaid title is also referred to as Title 19. On the federal side, it's 60.05%. That means the federal government contributes 60% of the funds needed for the Medicaid program, with the state share contributing 39.95%. With the public health emergency, it increased the federal share by 6.2%, reducing the state share by 39.95%. Similarly, on the CHIP side, we see the federal share higher, just over 72%, with the state share just under 28%, and the public health emergency increasing the federal portion by 4.34%. Again, reducing the state portion by that same amount. Now, in Florida, CHIP is one component of a larger program known as KidCare. KidCare is defined in statute and is administered by four entities: the Agency for Healthcare Administration, Florida Healthy Kids Corporation, the Department of Health, and the Department of Children and Families. Each partner plays an important role in determining eligibility and/or administering a key aspect of the program. Starting in the top left quadrant here with the Agency for Healthcare Administration, they serve as the lead agency for Medicaid and CHIP, and they're responsible for compliance and funding. The agency also administers Medicaid and Medicaids through contracts with managed care organizations, which are similar to health maintenance organizations, if you're familiar with that model. Florida Healthy Kids Corporation is responsible for processing CHIP applications, determining CHIP eligibility, and collecting appropriate premiums. Healthy Kids is also responsible for marketing on behalf of all of Florida KidCare and manages the KidCare call center. Furthermore, the corporation administers the health and dental insurance programs under its purview. The Florida Department of Health serves children with exceptional medical needs. The department is charged with determining clinical eligibility for their program and contracting with a managed care organization to serve the children who qualify. And finally, there's the Department of Children and Families, and they're responsible for determining Medicaid eligibility, as well as providing oversight of the Behavioral Health Network, which is a specialized program which treats the entire spectrum of behavioral health and substance use disorders. So putting this in a chart form is what I like to call my whiteboard. When I'm presenting this to new employees at the corporation, I stand in front and draw all of this out on my whiteboard. I don't have a whiteboard here, so I try to put it in a slide for you. Hopefully, if there's one thing from this presentation, you can take this, hang on to it, print it out, and hold on to it so when you're having discussions, you can see the different aspects of KidCare. So as we just learned, KidCare is administered by the four entities. And again, is it defined in statute? It includes Medicaid, Medikids, Healthy Kids, and the Children's Medical Services Program. We just discussed with respect to KidCare, Medicaid is administered by the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and it provides coverage for children from birth through 18. As you can see, we're working through each side. We'll go through each column and across, just so clear. So Medicaid receives two levels of federal funding. It's based on the child's age in relation to the federal poverty level. We'll dive a little bit more into poverty level in just a minute. For Medicaid families, they pay $0 each month. The enrollment for Medicaid is just north of 2.6 million, which can be seen by adding these two columns together. Medikids is also administered by the Agency for Healthcare Administration. It is for children who are aged 1 through 4 and also has federal funding support up to 200% using the 72% match rate. For those who are over 200%, there is a full pay or buy-in program which families can take advantage of. Families pay on the subsidized side $15 or $20 depending on their income level or the full cost of the program for the full pay program. And total enrollment for Medikids is 9,300. In 80. Healthy Kids is administered by the Florida Healthy Kids Corporation and covers school-age children from 5 through 18. Like Medikid, Healthy Kids is also federally funded and has federal funding support up to 200%, with a buy-in program above 200%. Similarly, families will pay $15 or $20, or their individual child would pay $259.50. For Healthy Kids, the total enrollment right now is at 106,790, but we'll dive more into enrollment in just a little bit as well. Last but not least is the Children's Medical Services. Again, it is administered by the Florida Department of Health, covers children from birth through 18 with the children that need exceptional medical care. Like Medicaid, it has two levels of federal assistance based on the child's age and the poverty level. Apart from funding and family contribution amounts, there are benefit and operational model differences between Medicaid and CHIP. To clarify, however, Medikids and Children's Medical Services leverage Medicaid benefits. So this comparison is between Medicaid and Healthy Kids. A primary difference between the two is that Medicaid has $0 copayment for children, whereas Healthy Kids has copayments ranging from $0 to $10 as permitted by statute. The reason for the copayments is twofold. First, it helps bring the overall cost of the program down by reducing the burden on the state. This is accomplished by trying to direct families to the correct place of care. For example, instead of taking your child to the emergency room for a non-emergency situation, take them to the family physician or pediatrician. Additionally, the copayments introduce this concept to families, which they will face as their economic outlook increases as they move into commercial insurance products. Another difference between Medicaid and CHIP are the benefit limitations. Medicaid provides coverage for all services so long as they are medically necessary. CHIP has legislative mandated limitations. However, those who meet the clinical eligibility criteria of Children's Medical Services, they are able to move into that program and have all of their services taken care of. From an operational perspective, Medicaid utilizes managed care organizations similar to HMOs, as I mentioned earlier, to provide services on a regional basis. Contrast that to Healthy Kids. We have two statewide managed care organizations as well as one regional managed care organization in the South Florida region, leaving three carriers overall, as well as three statewide dental carriers for Healthy Kids. This slide depicts the contract cycles for medical and dental services based on the administering entity. Medicaid is, however, set to launch their procurement in the coming months with an emphasis on providing a health system that is transparent, cost-effective, and of the highest quality. Florida Healthy Kids just recently awarded new dental contracts where their corporation realized a cost avoidance of $2.5 million in the first year alone. Additional successes in that contract include new performance guarantees to ensure the children and their family have the highest quality of service. Now that we have an understanding regarding administration, let's turn our attention to how families are enrolled. Once basic criteria is reviewed, such as being under age 19, being a Florida resident, a U.S. citizen, or lawfully residing immigrant, each child must go through an eligibility process, which looks at their household size, income, and age of child to place the child in the appropriate program. First, the household size is determined by understanding the household composition, such as how many parents are in the house, are there step-parents, siblings, other dependents. From there, you leverage this information primarily through the tax filing status and relationships of individuals living in the household. Once the household size is determined, then the income is calculated, first using electronic sources when available, such as wage data from the Department of Revenue or reemployment assistance data from the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity. With household size and income, the federal poverty level can then be determined. In pictorial form, we can visually represent how each of these programs fit together. As previously discussed, Medicaid, shown in dark blue, covers newborns up to 200% and children 1 through 18 up to 133% of the federal poverty level. Medikids, shown in pink, covers kids ages 1 through 4 up to 200% with a full pay option above 200%. Healthy Kids, similar to Medikids, covers up to 200% with a full pay option after that. One thing to note, I recognize on the screen, it's a little small font, but one thing to note is that due to the Affordable Care Act, Florida had to revise their appropriate standards, and we accomplished this through what we call standard disregards. And what it effectively did is take those thresholds from 200% to 210% for the CHIP program. On this chart, we're depicting the same information, but in dollar amounts. The first column shows the various family sizes. This is just an example. We have all family sizes, though, in the program. The first row of color shows the program, and the second row shows the federal poverty level range along with the family contribution. As an example, find the family of size of 4 on the left-hand side, and if you go over 3 columns to the right, you'll see that the upper limit is $60,000. What that means is that a family who makes $60,000 or less is eligible for most of the $20 monthly premium or potentially free or even lower cost insurance. So what does this cost? For the CHIP program and full pay, excluding Medicaid for a moment, we see that our total cost here is $465.9 million. Each of the components is broken out so you can see that detail. And as I mentioned, it's a split amongst 3 different entities. The family contribution is about $103.5 million. The federal share is $268.5 million. And the state share at 93.8. Putting that on a per child basis is that the total cost is $315.53, with the state share only being $63.40 per child per month. On this slide, we see the relationship between CHIP and full pay enrollment. The CHIP and full pay enrollment is the line denoted in blue, with to that of kid care, which is in pink, and that includes Medicaid. In general, when CHIP and full pay increase, we expect Medicaid to decline. This is a sign that the economy is likely improving as family socioeconomic status is moving up as their income brackets move up. So they're taking advantage of the appropriate income-based program. However, when the pandemic, and we saw all this actually going from 2016 to 2020, if you look on the chart, you see the blue line trending upwards with the pink line coming down. It was doing well. We saw enrollment in the CHIP and full pay improving with Medicaid declining. However, when the pandemic hit, many families were negatively impacted and lost their jobs. This led to a sharp decline in CHIP and full pay with a dramatic rise in Medicaid. This pattern has continued throughout the pandemic because, again, once children are enrolled in Medicaid, they may not disenroll unless certain exceptions occur. However, the end is in sight, and we expect the pattern to reverse over time. Over the next 12 to 14 months, the conferees of the Social Services Estimating Conference forecasts that enrollment will go through a rapid increase within CHIP. The expectation is that over 100,000 children will return to CHIP. This is a direct result of the unwinding of the public health emergency. Once those effects are realized, the forecast is expected to return to historical growth patterns, which are typically tied to the child population growth rate. So to recap, Florida KidCare currently serves over 2.7 million children through four programs. Medicaid serves over 2.6, Medikids over 9,000, Healthy Kids over 106,000, and the CHIP component of Children's Medical Services over 7,000. But our work is not done yet. Florida Healthy Kids Corporation, as mentioned before, is responsible for marketing for all of Florida KidCare. And there are an estimated 331,000 uninsured children in Florida, with 162,000 likely eligible for free or low-cost coverage. To help reduce the uninsured level, Florida Healthy Kids produces a statewide marketing campaign with an emphasis on the five counties with the highest number of uninsured, as you can see on the screen here. The corporation's campaign includes social media outreach, community partners and events, radio advertisements, and much more. It is the corporation's mission that all of Florida's children have access to affordable, comprehensive, and quality health care. We stand ready to serve this body in the furtherance of that mission. I thank you for your time and welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Noel. A very thorough presentation, and I'm sorry that we deprived you of being able to draw the chart out on the whiteboard. I'll see if Chris can get you a whiteboard next
thank
time
you,
you come in there. Members, questions of Mr. Noel. Representative Franklin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all the work that you do. Health insurance is so important for children, so just thanks for everything you do for the state. My first question I have is around the reimbursements. I know within Medicaid, oftentimes maybe some physicians might not be as incentivized to accept patients based off of Medicaid reimbursements. And I'm curious if we see that same trend with any of the KidCare programs. And if so, what's the proportion of children that oftentimes might not can receive care because of the backlog and the small amount of physicians that might be accepting it?
Mr. Noel, can you answer, attempt to answer that for Representative Franklin?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. We require in our health and dental contracts time and distance standards that to require that our members are able to access care close to them. And it's not just about a person being there, it's also about that person being able to have an open panel, right? Because you can have all the access in the world, but if it's closed panel, meaning they're no longer accepting new patients, then you don't have access. So we go through a number of reports, both quarterly self-reported by the plans, as well as an annual look back through an external quality review organization, to ensure that our children do have access to the services that are required and expected. To the reimbursement, Medicaid has done a lot of work around pediatricians. There is a physician incentive program that is directed towards the pediatricians. I'm not representing AHCA, and I'm sure they could speak a lot more detail about that than I can. However, we have done parity analysis, meaning we have done comparative analyses to see where are we in relationship not just to Medicaid, but also commercial and Medicare. I don't have those results in front of me right now, but we have had an actuary conduct that analysis. I'd be happy to provide those results to you.
Follow up, Representative Franklin. Excellent answer. Only could be delivered by a chief operating officer. So thank you. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I have a couple questions. I'll start with my first one. What is the advantage to having four agencies involved in carrying out the coverage of insurance for children in the state of Florida?
Mr. Noel.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative. So, great question, complicated answer. The first part of that is that the legislature, or that Healthy Kids initially was started well before CHIP ever became in existence, 5 years beforehand. Started out at the county level and grew to become the statewide program. At this point, we are co-equals in facilitating the services of CHIP as well as KidCare as a whole. Each entity, though, has its specific focus. So as an example, Healthy Kids, we are, the legislative intent is for us to dive in and focus on school-age children, but also to ensure that there are affordable insurance products for kids. So with that singular focus, we don't lose sight of all the other noise that can come at us, like some of the other agencies may be directing, you know, from anywhere from long-term care to other things at Department of Health, the pandemic, the crisis of that, we're able to singular focus all of our efforts on children. So what it allows us to do is make sure we are taking care of those that need it the most.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for DCF to be the partner that does eligibility, that prevents Florida Healthy Kids, which is kind of more of a public-private partnership because of the managed care aspect of it. Why doesn't the state divest itself of that piece of the puzzle and have Florida Healthy Kids do the eligibility piece? And follow up to that, why can't the managed care programs then market, because they are private companies and have a different budget than the state of Florida, but they are not allowed to market to the families? So while you spoke about a marketing budget that you have for the big counties, how much is the state budget? And wouldn't the HMOs potentially be able to take that on and save the state that money by marketing their plans themselves? I know that was a long, complicated question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Mr. Noah, can you unwrap
some of that for Representative Skidmore and the members?
If I may, Chair, I'd like to try to restate that to make sure I understand. I think we have two
questions.
Yeah,
that's probably not going to happen. Okay. Do the best you can with what you heard, because that was a long question. If you want, can you segment his question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is two different questions. I was just putting them both out there. One is, why don't we have a more efficient system that doesn't require four state agencies, no, well, three state agencies and one public-private partnership to manage the CHIP program? And secondly, the question is, why not take advantage of the HMO opportunity to market the plans themselves so that the state doesn't have that cost burden?
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Noel.
From the eligibility standpoint, we have a policy of no wrong door. So with the Department of Children and Families, when a family applies, they're able to apply for not just Medicaid. They are able to apply across all of the different income-based programs, such as TANF, food assistance programs, as well as other available state and federal programs.
Like a one-stop shop.
Yes, sir. So by doing that with Department of Children and Families, it makes it simpler for a family to go through that process rather than dividing that up across all those different functions, if you will, or services. When Department of Children and Families goes through that process and they review the information, they are then able to pass that information to Healthy Kids if they find the child to be ineligible for Medicaid due to income. Any information that is verified by Department of Children and Families, Florida Healthy Kids accepts, and we do not make the family go through that process a second time. For families that are purely looking for health insurance, they could apply one through us or two through the federal marketplace. Again, with the federal marketplace, if that process, they do screenings, they'll make determinations. If they find that a child is eligible for one of the low-cost options, they will refer them either to Medicaid or to us, and we'll process that accordingly as well. So that's to the eligibility. On the marketing side, today we do leverage and work with our carriers to help get the word out about becoming covered, about health initiatives, and other aspects as well. So we do leverage that today. The budget for marketing is within Healthy Kids, allows us to look at things globally and look at things holistically and figure out how to best partner with community partners, with county level officials or schools, as well as creating a broader social media presence that looks at all of kid care rather than just one particular MCO.
How do you do, Representative Skidmore?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pretty good. May I have a follow-up?
Sure, of course.
Thank you. So the slide that shows us how many kids are uninsured means that the state is not getting to those kids through their marketing, through its marketing plan. So is there any further opportunity for the state to get this message out, to get the kids insured? Because it doesn't seem like we're reaching them. So,
Mr. Noel, can you attempt that one?
Yes, sir. Thank
Every time I think that she set the bar, she sets it higher. So do your best.
Thank you, sir. That number represents just over 7% of the children in the state of Florida are uninsured. So the way I like to look at that is if you're familiar, most of your businessmen or women understand with marketing and the bell curve where you have early adopters and late adopters. These are our late adopters. They are going to be the hard ones to get. Right? It's not to say our work should be stopped or that we shouldn't be continuing pursue. We need to meet them where they're at. So that's getting boots on the ground. That's getting more community partners. That's getting people who are familiar with where these individuals are and work in those individual communities and working with them. So is there more we can do? The short answer is yes. We allocate the funds we have in the best way, and mindfulness that we do, again, focusing on those five highest uninsured because we believe that by targeting those areas, it'll help bring down the overall.
Representative Rudman, you have the floor for a question or comment, followed up by Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, sir, for that very educational presentation on an extremely complex topic. I don't know how you did it personally. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Having said that, I do have three questions if I can be permitted. But the questions are simple. So number one, I always have to start with what percentage of Florida doctors currently take Florida Healthy Kids? Do we have that number?
Mr. Noel.
I do not have that number.
But you'll get it and you'll get it back to us, right?
I will do my best.
Yes, sir. Second question.
And they get easier as we go. Don't worry about it. Looking at the Florida Kid Care graph, when we look at Florida Healthy Kids, for families that are above the 200% of the federal poverty level, it looks like that's where they actually buy in 100% into the program. I was looking at that monthly premium, and to me, that looks like a pretty good deal. I was wondering, does that premium ever change? And if so, what factors is that premium based on?
No.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. Yes, the premium does change. As this is a buy-in program, it's intended to cover the full cost of the program. Every year, we go through a rate adjustment cycle with our carriers, and as part of that process, we set the new full pay premium. Just recently, it did rise to this $259.50, which you'll see it does include dental for families. If they chose it, there is an option without dental, but what you see on the screen is with the dental.
Your third question.
And the simplest question, but it's just to educate all of us. We may be struggling with the idea of children's medical services versus the Healthy Kids product. I think Healthy Kids might actually be a little bit of a misnomer. If you wouldn't mind educating us, what types of patients are appropriate for Florida Healthy Kids and which types of patients end up on children's medical services? Thank you very much.
Mr. Noel.
Thank you, Chair. Within the application, there is an option for the parent or the custodian to indicate that they believe their child has exceptional health needs. That could range from a variety of different situations. Some that you might consider are more disabled. Others might be a little bit more minor in their needs. They could be more behavioral or they could be behavioral focused. It's really about providing the families that additional care or additional care plans and really working with the family holistically that the Children's Medical Services Program offers. Contrast that for a moment with Healthy Kids. We are the school-age children, generally the healthy population, hence Healthy Kids, and we wouldn't expect most of the kids on there to have higher acuity, meaning their health overall is better.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
The fourth question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. So in regards, for example, if a child has asthma, let's say, from an early age, which plan would be appropriate for a child with asthma? Thank you.
Mr. Noel.
Thank you, Chair. Asthma also has varying levels, so I would say it depends first. I am an economist, after all. For your typical day-to-day run-of-the-mill asthma, we do treat that and see that in healthy kids. If you have a child that has more of the extreme side, they might end up in Children's Medical Services, but still likely within healthy kids.
Right. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson, you're recognized for a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. Fortunately, Representative Rudden's question answered the lion's share of my question, which was around concerns I had about the state potentially subsidizing insurance premiums for some of the wealthiest residents, which it appears that that's not the case. But I do have a question pertaining to that. Can you speak a little bit more about any other eligibility requirements, specifically for Medi-Kids and healthy kids for those who earn over 200% of the federal poverty level? Are there any other requirements other than age?
Mr. No, you're recognized.
Chair. Regardless of being subsidized or full pay, they need to meet the basic requirements. And those basic requirements are here, but they must be under the age of 18, Florida resident, U.S. citizen or lawfully residing, can't be in a public institution. And then the income eligibility here is to define being under or over, depending on which they fall in, is where they would be for coverage.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this has nothing to do with health status or pre-existing conditions or anything of that nature.
Mr. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, we do not have any sort of qualifiers around health condition. In fact, we have prohibitions against that.
All right. The ranking member, Bartleman, you have the floor for question or comment.
Question and maybe a little comment if you can't get into it. Can you just go over, for the benefit of the committee, the funding cliff that occurs with CHIP and how that impacts the Alice families?
Mr. Noel, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of that? You've done so good up until now.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Representative Bartleman. So the funding cliff that Representative Bartleman is referring to, displaying up here on this slide, it's really two slides together can paint this picture. But this one will focus on healthy kids. First, if we recall, as we were just discussing, Florida Healthy Kids for the subsidized program has $15 or $20 a monthly premium. It then goes to $250, and that's for the entire household. So whether you have one child or three children, you're paying $15 or $20 a month. You then go to $259.50 per child per month. So you see right here on this chart, Representative is alluding to, is using the family size of four. Again, we went across, saw 60,000. You go over that, you get, you know, by a penny, you're then at the next level for the buy-in program. So you go to the $259.50.
Okay. How did you do?
He did very well. Can I just make a comment?
Sure, of course. You're the ranking member.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to point out that the funding cliff is a real issue for our Alice families, if you speak to the United Way, that the percentage of this need and this cost in their household goes up 800% to 1,100% depending on the household. So one penny over, $2 over, families have to choose what are they going to fund, primary needs, home, food, childcare, automobile insurance. What drops off the secondary needs? And if you look at the chart on page 16, you'll see that half of the uninsured children in Florida are the Alice families who do not, I'm suspecting because they speculate that 162 are eligible for CHIP. So that leads to that those working families who need a hand up, who do not need a hand out, are unable to jump to the 800 to 1100% change. So I just wanted to point that out, which is really important because all of us have these families in our district and they do an amazing job. So I want to thank them very much. And I also want to point out they have vision and mental health care in the CHIP program because all these committees we all work together on the health care, and it's very difficult for private insurance. Not all of them cover mental health care needs, yet we do in the state of Florida. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, member. Is there any other member that has a question for Mr. Noel or wants to make a comment? Mr. Noel, I want to applaud you for the fabulous job that you've done with all of these questions, multi-level and step four questions that you were posed today. You rose to the occasion. And I would like to admonish all the members to save these presentations that have been printed out for you in color. I'll give you a little tip. If you'll save them and put them in a notebook, you will find a need to go back and refer yourself to the information that was presented in our committees. So, and you can go back home and you can be the best speech giver on some of these topics. Maybe not as good as Mr. Noel, but you'll be pretty good. So thank you, sir, for being here today. Last chance. Anybody want to ask Mr. Noel a question? Thank you, Mr. Noel, for being here today.
Thank you, sir.
Any other business needs to come before the committee today? If not, Ranking Member Bartleman moves that we rise without objection. We will stand adjourned. On time.